In his second inaugural address, President Clinton called the United States the world's indispensable nation, referring to the view that America is the world's only superpower and the leader of the free world. 15 years later, in his January 2012 State of the Union address, President Obama reminded us of Clinton's words and pledged to keep the United States the one indispensable nation in world affairs. But according to Vali Nasser, a former State Department advisor on Pakistan and Afghanistan, this has not been the case. In his new book, The Dispensable Nation, American Foreign Policy in Retreat, he argues that under the Obama administration, American foreign policy has taken a step backwards, leaving a power vacuum that he says will inevitably be filled by China. The book is published by Doubleday, and I'm very pleased that it brings Mr. Nasser to our show today. Hello.
Hello.
You served as the senior advisor to Ambassador Richard Holbrooke, the special envoy to Afghanistan and Pakistan from 2009 to 2011. Had you worked in government before?
No, but I had interacted with government officials quite frequently, briefing them on Middle East issues, on South Asia issues, and I worked also on the presidential campaign of then-Secretary Clinton with Ambassador Holbrooke.
So you were an academic who had expertise in this area?
I was an academic with expertise in this area.
And had you wanted to get into government?
No, but I had collaborated with Ambassador Holbrooke prior to the elections. And I also thought that this was a unique opportunity to have an impact on our policy in this region of the world.
What was your specific role within the State Department?
Was to help the State Department develop a new strategy for managing the Afghanistan-Pakistan situation, particularly the diplomatic side of it. As the president a new president had come in, he had to think through about what to do about Afghanistan war, how to shape a new strategy. And so my initial contribution in that office was to help Ambassador Holbrooke formulate that.
And did his ideas about what was going on differ from his fellow diplomats?
Well, Holbrooke believed that it was not a good idea necessarily for us to put too many troops on the ground, because the more troops we put in, the more likely would be we wouldn't be able to sustain them and we would withdraw faster. And he believed Afghanistan had to be a marathon rather than a sprint. We have to put troops in, but we have to put at a level that is sustainable, and then we have to use those troops to get to a political settlement that would bring more sustainable stability once we leave.
So had he been a supporter of the surge?
I don't think he was. I think he thought the surge either would fail or would get us into another Vietnam. He didn't think that we would be putting 130,000 troops and $100 billion a year cost for the sufficient amount of time that it would take to conclude this matter in a satisfactory way.
What was his relationship like with his boss, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton? They had been friends before, hadn't they?
They had been friends before. They were very close. I think Secretary Clinton trusted him, his vision, his wisdom. She was supportive of his views. They may have differed on certain aspects of this. I think Secretary Clinton was probably more assertive about a military footprint in Afghanistan, but she was also very attentive to the argument for diplomacy. I think they had a very close working relationship in shoring up the role for diplomacy and the State Department in general policymaking after the sort of the bruising that State Department got during the Bush period to restore it to the place that it ought to have.
But throughout the book, you describe the frustration felt by members of the State Department when it comes to working with the White House. What was so frustrating?
Well, partly it was turf battles, but also this was a White House that has centralized policymaking very much in its own hands. And it views the other agencies of government to be merely implementing the strategy that they formulate. But at the same time, it was at that point in time managed by people who weren't particularly experienced in foreign policy and whose real point of reference was the elections of 2012, the president's domestic issues, and that created a sense of disconnect between what we need to do abroad vis-a-vis what's happening home in policymaking.
So was the impression that we got that President Obama and Secretary of State Clinton were working hand in glove, were in agreement over everything? Was that a false impression? Was that just the way they presented themselves?
No, I think it's true. And in fact, the extent to that things worked is really because Secretary Clinton had the trust and respect of the president and had a direct line to him. The problem was that the way that the president has set up the White House to manage foreign policy, it's too narrow, it's too inexperienced.
Well, who is he listening to?
By and large, a very small circle of advisors, most of whom came out of the campaign and had and their ear was really to the political situation at home rather than foreign policy imperatives. So the State Department and increasingly also the Pentagon and the CIA had a difficult time getting the foreign policy agenda before the president, and therefore it became increasingly conflictual.
Well, those people who had worked in the campaign obviously saw the Clintons as the opposition. Did that cause any trouble, especially since Richard Holbrook had this long-term relationship with the Clintons?
That's probably the case, particularly early on, when the onus was put on Clinton and Holbrook to show that they were team players. But increasingly, the issue went beyond the distrust of the campaign period. The people who came in from the campaign around President Obama thought that they had won the elections handily. They had done something historic. They really didn't need to listen to anybody else, and they knew better.
How much sway did the military hold over the president's decision-making?
I think early on a lot, because I think the military came out of Iraq victorious and triumphant. There was a sense that they saved Iraq. And there was a lot of pressure domestically on the president to basically listen more to the military when he came to Afghanistan than listen to the diplomats. And that's why the president did not consider a diplomatic option for Afghanistan at all and went with the request of General McChrystal sending more troops in.
And McChrystal and Petraeus, as I understand, both may have voted for Obama. So there is probably some kind of a feeling of, connection between them.
Well, I think it's not so much partisan as it is that the military thought that it has a right to dominate foreign policy because they saved Iraq. And it's very difficult for civilians to push back and say foreign policy is really the domain of the diplomats, war making is the domain of the generals, and our purpose in Afghanistan should be to use the generals to get to a peace agreement.
On the other hand, the generals have pointed out that there's a changing role of the military and that they, to some degree, have to be involved with diplomacy. They have to be involved with simple things like making sure that the electrical system is working in a town.
Well, that's the way they conceived the military's role, which came out of this counterinsurgency in Iraq, which means that you not only fight the insurgents, but you also build villages, build economy, help with agriculture. And that's why their vision of our presence in Afghanistan proved to be so expensive and unsustainable. But, you know, in the past, we've always had a balance between diplomacy and threat and use of force. So in Bosnia or in Vietnam at the end, we did use the military, but the purpose was to use force to get the opposition to the table. We never looked at the military necessarily as the solution and then tell the diplomats, your job is to support the war makers. It should be the other way around. Holbrook thought war makers ought to support the diplomats.
My guest is Vali Nasr, N-A-S-R. He's dean of the Paul H. Nitze School of Advanced International Studies at Johns Hopkins University. And he is the author of the best-selling book, The Shia Revival, also Forces of Fortune. And his latest is called The Dispensable Nation, American Foreign Policy in Retreat. It is published by Doubleday. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Shortly after he took office, President Obama asked for a quick strategy review of the situation in Afghanistan, mm-hmm. which would become known as the Riedel Report. Mm-hmm. What were the findings of the report?
Well, the report identified the insurgency to be on the rise. It identified Pakistan as being part of the problem, and then it recommended to the president what was called a fully resourced counterinsurgency, which is the strategy we had in Iraq of a heavy military footprint combined with what you called nation building, working on electricity, providing security, putting soldiers in every village and town. It recommended that we adopt that for Afghanistan as well. And the president responded by immediately sending 17,000 additional troops.
So from what you said earlier, Ambassador Holbrooke wouldn't have agreed with that.
Ambassador Albrook thought that before we go down the path of buying into the counterinsurgency strategy, we ought to actually have a much more thorough strategic review. The president engaged in that strategic review in September, November of 2009. But the cabal in the White House around him deliberately kept the option of a diplomatic solution off the table.
And why do you think the cabal did that? Just because that's what they believed in, or was it also just a power struggle? Well, we want to get our way.
I think mostly was because of domestic reasons. The perception was that a Democratic president, regardless of how much he says he was going to change America's foreign policy from the Bush period, really could not move too far away from where we ended up with the Iraq War, and that he couldn't not give the military what they wanted. So the president, who was all about engagement, ended up not even considering engagement as an option.
It's interesting that he ran on 2008 pretty much withdrawing troops from Iraq and to a large degree from Afghanistan, and then goes in the opposite direction because he feels that he is vulnerable to attack from the right on American military strategy.
Exactly.
Because there was a lot of talk about the surge and who supported the surge and who didn't support the surge. John McCain made a big thing about it.
Exactly. In other words, very quickly, despite his popular victory, President Obama fell into the trap of playing the same foreign policy game. And in the end, even to this day, our perspective on the region, Afghanistan, Pakistan, the Middle East, is still very much in the mold of the Bush period, except instead of using troops on the ground, we are relying on drones from the air. But it is the same heavy foot, military-dominated approach.
In your opinion, do you think the troop surge in Afghanistan had any lasting positive effect?
Well, it had only a temporary effect, because even if you went by General Petraeus and General McChrystal's strategy, you had to keep the troops on the ground for far longer. Counterinsurgency is not a one-year deal. So what we did the worst, we surged and then we withdrew immediately. And I think that created a lot of confusion in the region. And I think that's become a problem. It's damaged our global standing.
And for people in Afghanistan, it just repeats a pattern, doesn't it? After the Soviet Union was expelled, the United States pretty much withdrew from any show of interest in Afghanistan. And now we do the surge and then withdraw again?
Yes. And actually what they see is that we have neither won the war, nor have we really sued for a lasting peace. We just said we tried for 1 year for our own domestic reasons, and now we're leaving, and we have a narrative that we're comfortable with but doesn't make sense to them. So there's a sense that we're just basically abandoning the fighting, and with the Taliban still sitting, waiting for its moment of attack, and everybody thinks that this is all going to come undone.
Didn't Vice President Biden want to focus attention and resources on the CIA and its efforts to hunt al-Qaeda in Pakistan?
Yes, he did, and increasingly we're adopting that strategy. And
Holbrooke wouldn't have liked that strategy either.
No, Holbrooke thought that in the end you have to get a regionally supported political settlement for Afghanistan, that at least everybody around that region would have a dog in the fight, would have a stake in protecting it. There would be something you leave behind in terms of a deal.
Now, his opinions were well known. Why do you think Obama appointed him to this job?
Well, that's the peculiar thing.
It's called AFPAC.
Well, they created this policy area that was called AFPAC, and actually people in the region didn't like this shorthand. But the reality is that the president appointed a czar, if you would, for the Afghanistan-Pakistan policy area, and then immediately ignored him and his advisors tried to undermine him. And that actually made it more difficult for us to convince people around the world about our policy when the chief messenger does not even have the public support of the White House.
Although he did have a number of diplomatic successes, didn't he? I'm talking about Ambassador Holbrooke, the transit trade agreement, for example.
Yes. Well, he was a fighter. He never gave up. So as much as they pushed him aside, he always found a way to move things along. And his opinion was that at some point in time, everybody will come to their senses. And he understood very early on, look, you want to fix this war, you got to get Pakistan on board, you got to create some kind of cartilage between Pakistan and Afghanistan. And the best way of doing that is to get them to negotiate on trade and transportation and these sorts of things. And it was productive. In the end, the two countries have signed the first treaty since Pakistan was created between them as part of this effort that Holbrooke made.
A number of people have said that most of the problems of Afghanistan are caused by Pakistan. Did Holbrooke see it that way?
Yes, he did see it that way. But he also believed that you're not going to change the foreign policy of a country as large as Pakistan by just arriving, demanding a change, and then leaving the next day. That we have to also work with Pakistan, engage Pakistan, try to change public opinion and gradually change its direction.
Is it your sense that Pakistan sees in the end that it will have that Afghanistan will be part of its sphere of influence?
That's what they wanted. But what they saw is that we dashed in with 130,000 troops and then immediately told them we're leaving. So there's nothing compelling on the ground that would tell them they ought to change course.
Well, Pakistan has had problems with the Taliban in its own country, and yet hasn't it offered safe haven to the Taliban and other terrorist organizations that have caused them problems? At one point in the book, you described Pakistan as viewing the Taliban as a strategic asset, despite the fact that they kill people in their own country.
Well, there is a blowback effect to using the Taliban. The Taliban have not been a clean weapon. But the reality is that Pakistan went down this path because it has bigger issues. It's afraid of that a stable Afghanistan will be a threat to Pakistan. It will be pro-India, and it will try to cause separatism among Pakistan's Pashtuns.
So this is so much about the tension between India and Pakistan that goes all the way back to partition.
That's right. And also, we often forget that this is not about liking extremists or not. This is about geostrategy. And Holbrooke also understood you're going to only change a country's geostrategy if you address its fears and address its ambitions. And we were not doing that with Pakistan. And I think part of his effort was to engage Pakistan and see what do they want in Afghanistan and can they get it in a way other than through the Taliban.
Well, officially at least, Pakistan is an ally of the United States. It's one of the biggest recipients of American foreign aid, mostly military aid.
Almost all military aid, and this is not always aid either. It's actually really money we're paying them for specific services that they are rendering our troops, like access roads to port facilities so that we can supply our troops in Afghanistan, and giving us access to drone program and bases to support it and those sorts of things.
Well, they gave us access. On the other hand, they allowed Osama bin Laden to live for many years in Abbottabad. We don't know for sure whether the government was aware of it, but I can't imagine it wasn't aware of it. From what I read in the newspaper, the Pakistan people hate the United States more and more every day.
Well, yes. I mean, Pakistan is a very difficult problem. It's been allies on sometimes on Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays.
And we haven't been able to buy their love.
Well, we're not paying enough to buy their love. I mean, you know, the little amount of money we give, first of all, none of it really gets to the Pakistani people. So all they see is this cynical deal that we allow, that their generals allow our drones to attack their territory, and in return for which they get some money. But they don't really see any kind of a positive impact on their daily lives from a relationship with America. And that's why they're seething in anger over drones and over what they see as a one-sided policy by us. But at the same time, you know, we're in a tight spot with Pakistan. It's not a country we can ignore. It's nuclear-armed. It has 180 million people. It has a lot of extremists, and it's in a very bad neighborhood. And therefore, you know, the idea to say, well, this is too difficult, let us just wash our hands of it, really doesn't serve America's interests.
My guest is Vali Nasser. His latest book, The Dispensable Nation, American Foreign Policy in Retreat, it is published by Doubleday. We'll continue our conversation after we take a little break. And we are back with Vali Nasser, N-A-S-R, Dean of the Paul H. Nitze School of Advanced International Studies at Johns Hopkins University. His latest book, The Dispensable Nation, American Foreign Policy in Retreat. It is published by Doubleday. Let's talk a little more about those drones. How has it affected our relationship? Pakistan, on the one hand, condemns them. On the other hand, it allows them.
Well, drones have lived for a very long time in a dark place. For a very long time, even in the United States, you were not allowed to talk about them. The problem is that drones are seen by the local population as daily airstrikes. So it's a foreign aircraft that crosses over the borders and shoots targets in your territory.
Even if those targets are people you don't necessarily support?
Well, that becomes murky because also they claim civilians get killed, but yes, people they don't support. But it has implications for nationalism. Either their government is complicit, which they want to know why and what is it getting in return, and how come their government is allowing a foreign country to operate in its territory, or that their government knows nothing about this and can't stop it, which means that the government is emasculated and feeble. So either way, this really doesn't wash down well with the local population. And that's why Pakistanis have always asked, make it a joint program, make it co-managed, so that we can tell our population that we ourselves are targeting these bad people. It's not a foreign government doing it.
Does the current situation in Pakistan, where former General Pervez Musharraf, who ran the country for 8 years, was arrested last week, today a Pakistani court refused to extend bail for him in connection with accusations of his complicity in the murder of former Prime Minister Benazir Bhutto, is this an American problem, or is this just internal Pakistani politics, partly perhaps because he decided to fire judges when he imposed emergency rule in November 2007. The judges are getting back at him.
Well, I think actually General Musharraf sort of has outlived his shelf life. He has had a longer life in the United States, in people's imaginations as a political actor than in Pakistan. He was effective because he was both controlling the government and the military at one time and didn't have to respond to anybody so he can get things done. But now that he's a civilian, people know that he's not really viable as a politician. He made a mistake going back home.
He has no support from the military, which is really the power in Pakistan?
No, the only thing the military cares here is not to set a precedent of a former general being hanged. And that's the only thing that's going to save his life. But General Musharraf faces some serious legal issues over extrajudicial killings of separatist activists and politicians, over the death of former Prime Minister Benazir Bhutto, over firing of judges, even over staging a coup in 1999, which was technically illegal. And he had some sense that somehow he's going to go back and he's going to be politically popular and he's going to win the day. And in reality, he's a sideshow to the elections in Pakistan. He can't even run in them. He doesn't have any political party. But all the legal troubles that he was sort of downplaying have come to the fore, and I think he's facing some serious problems.
Now, the other day we had William Dalrymple on our show. He's written a book about the first British invasion of Afghanistan, and Afghanistan has a long history of resisting invading armies. It's even earned a nickname among historians as the place where empires go to die.
That's right.
But didn't many Afghans welcome the United States initially because we'd liberated them from the oppressive Taliban?
They did, but you know, any occupying army only has a very short honeymoon, and very quickly the local population tires of outsiders telling them what to do, and especially between 2002 and 2009, governance, the economy, many things began to go wrong in Afghanistan, and so particularly in southern Afghanistan, resentments began to brew, and that helped the Taliban.
Did they see Hamid Karzai as an American puppet?
Many do. Many do. And that actually is the reason why Karzai acts in a very irrational and erratic and bombastic way with us, because he constantly feels like he has to shore up his own nationalist credentials by being publicly anti-American.
And you describe him as being no more than the glorified mayor of Kabul.
Yes, in effect, you know, he literally doesn't really control a military power. that would be viable in Afghanistan today. Even the military that he has is now managed, run, and trained by the United States. There are two real military forces in Afghanistan today, the United States and the Taliban. And the fight is between them, and the whole issue is between them. In many ways, you know, we've tried to shore up Karzai because we want to give the impression that there is a real Afghan government. But in reality, most Afghans know that Karzai's writ doesn't extend too much beyond the palace without American support.
And if Americans left, the Taliban would just be able to march back into Kabul?
The only thing that would block them is the other ethnic forces in Afghanistan, which would get support from Russia, Iran, India, and others, and that they have equities and assets and interests that they want to protect. So it's possible that the Taliban will not actually march into Kabul, but they will take over large swaths of southern Afghanistan.
Well, Afghanistan does share a border with Iran. How much influence does Tehran have over the country's affairs?
A lot. Iran has influence over politicians, journalists, civil society groups, people in the government. Some of those factions I mentioned that are anti-Taliban over the commercial side of things. And there are parts of Afghanistan in the western part which are pretty much integrated into the Iranian economy.
So has Afghanistan become a place where its neighbors carry out proxy wars with each other and with the United States?
It was like that before we went in, and because we failed to actually put together some kind of a agreement to turn Afghanistan to a Switzerland, let's say, between larger warring neighbors, that in the absence of anything to prevent that from happening, once we leave, Afghanistan is going to go back to where it was before we came in.
Well, when we talk about tensions throughout most of the Muslim world, it's often about Sunni versus Shiite. Is that true in Afghanistan? There is a large Shiite presence, although it is a predominantly Sunni country. Or are the real tensions there between tribal groups and people who speak different languages?
It's more about tribal groups than ethnic groups, but about 20% of Afghanistan are Shia. But it becomes important because you also have a big Shia population in Pakistan, and also because Iran, which is a big player in Afghanistan, is seen as a Shia country. So inevitably, the sectarian rivalry between Iran and Saudi Arabia and Sunni and Shia factions in Pakistan will play itself out in Afghanistan as well.
Well, Afghanistan became a place where people from all over the Muslim world came to fight the Russians. Is that still felt there? Have people remained? Are we also seeing it as a place where some of the tensions that we see throughout the Muslim world, or the Arab world especially, are being played out?
No. Most of the Arabs left.
Well, you still have al-Qaeda as a force, don't you?
But they are mainly in northwest Pakistan. So there's very little of them in Afghan territory. And these days, more of those kinds of fighters are going to Syria or Libya than they are to Afghanistan. The big question is, if and when the United States leaves, would al-Qaeda want to go back into Afghanistan? And again, we don't have a deal with the Taliban that, you know, they have signed on to preventing that from happening. So we don't know.
Even if the Karzai government was good and wasn't corrupt and wasn't riddled with nepotism, do you think that the people of Afghanistan would be able to go beyond their deep-seated cultural differences and work together in order to create a successful nation?
If there was if the United States would remain as a force there longer. If you looked at the case of Bosnia, the NATO forces have been in Bosnia since 1990s. And the longer they stay, the more they help people to develop relations and accept to live with one another and rebuild their fragile political system. The fact that we're leaving Afghanistan so quickly means there's not enough time to bury the ghosts of war.
One of the main arguments you make in this book is that the United States under President Obama has taken a step back from its responsibility as a world leader, which you argue will have negative effects the world over. What are some examples of this failure that you're talking about?
There are examples in Europe vis-a-vis international institutions. But the most obvious examples you see is in the Middle East and South Asia. It's very clear once you get out of the United States, you go to the region, that the main message that's coming from Washington is that we're not going to be engaged in this region. We don't want to take leadership. We will want to lead from behind, if you would call it. In other words, others should take the initiative. We don't want to be engaged in Egypt. We don't want to be engaged in Libya, in Tunisia, in Syria. We don't want to play the role that we played. And ultimately, most people outside read this as a general new approach in the United States to foreign policy, which says, you know, we ought to be focused at home.
But wouldn't that be welcome that the United States isn't trying to meddle in their affairs?
No, I think there is a lot of criticism about bad American policies abroad.
And well, Syria, for example, there's a fear that just backing the insurgents would mean that we may very well wind up with people who we think are as bad as Assad taking over the country.
Well, that's a debate here.
Yeah.
In the region and in Europe and across the world, the argument is that even before getting to backing rebels with weapons, etc., that the United States could have play a much more important role in humanitarian affairs, in creating a diplomatic a pathway to arriving at a ceasefire. And I also think not supporting the rebels means that other people are supporting them and are supporting the wrong rebels, which someday is going to come and bite us.
What about North Korea? Have we handled that well?
I think the North Koreans are looking at the way we're handling Egypt and Afghanistan and Syria, and they're taking their lesson that there's a lot of room to push the United States before you run into trouble.
Now, we don't have much time, but should point out that Richard Holbrooke died suddenly of a rare heart condition in December 2010, was succeeded by Mark Grossman, and then John Kerry has taken over as Secretary of State. Have we seen changes in direction as a result?
No, because by and large, I think the administration came up with a narrative it's comfortable with, which is we're going to leave and we're going to hand over security in Afghanistan to an Afghan security force that we will train and leave behind. And I think that's basically is the story they're going with, and so they don't need to change course on that.
You argue that one of the most disastrous outcomes of our new foreign policy will be the increase in China's influence in the Middle East. Doesn't China have its own domestic problems right now?
China does, but for China, Middle East matters a lot. That's where they get their energy. The stability of Western China, where it has a big Muslim population with separatism, greatly depends on.
But they go after the Uyghurs, and I assume the rest of the Muslim world sees them as repressing their Muslim minority.
Right, but also controlling the Uyghurs requires China to have a much bigger footprint in countries that neighbor the Uyghur region: Pakistan, Afghanistan, Central Asian republics. China is also looking at the Middle East as a big market for its exports. It's generally looking at is investing in the Middle East heavily in varieties of sectors of the economy. So it's approaching the Middle East the way it approached Africa.
We have very little time, but can this all be corrected within the next 3.5 years of the Obama administration?
Well, if we don't correct it, we're going to pay the cost. There is a cost to inaction and there's a cost to retreat. And I think before going too far down the road, as a nation, we ought to debate this. We ought to look at where we're heading and how we are perceived with eyes wide open.
Vale Nasser will be giving a talk and signing books tonight at 6 o'clock at the International Peace Institute. That's at 777 United Nations Plaza. His book, The Dispensable Nation, American Foreign Policy in Retreat, is published by Doubleday. Do you have any sense that people in Washington are reading this book?
They are.
Paying attention?
They are. I hear from a lot of people, and I think the debate on where our foreign policy is and where it should go is welcome.
Thank you so much for being on our show.
Thank you.
Tomorrow's show, Rolling Stone's Matt Taibbi talks about whether bankers and brokers manipulated the market rates that affect global borrowing costs and why the case is reminiscent of the LIBOR scandal last year. Chuck Close describes the process of using large-scale Polaroid photographs to create his paintings. And then Jessica Soffer discusses her novel called Tomorrow There Will Be Apricots. And the nation's Jeremy Scahill talks about America's covert wars and the elite soldiers who operate in more than 100 countries around the world. Leonard Lopate Show is produced by Blakeney Schick, Stephen Valentino, and Julia Corcoran. Melissa Egan is the executive producer. Debbie Daughtry was at the audio controls. We had help today from Matthew McDonough and Kita Sood and contributing producer Fran Jacobs. I'm Leonard Lopate, your host. Thanks for listening. We'll see you tomorrow.